Not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
Welcome to Cultural Baggage on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. I am Dean Becker. Our producer tonight is Steve Nolan. Well, there's not much tonight for drug war news, but I do urge you to listen to 420 Drug War News Monday through Friday right here on KPFT, somewhere around 420 each day. We will have two guests from Canada tonight, Senator Pierre Claude Nolan, who helped to author their recently released report calling for the legalization of cannabis, and Eugene Oscapella of the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy, author of How Drug Prohibition Finances and Otherwise Enables Terrorism. We will also play more of an interview I did yesterday with Valerie Corral, the director of the WAM, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana in Santa Cruz, California, where the DEA busted them for growing their own medicine. I want to address something right up front, though. Terror is as terror does. I'm pissed off, likely as not, so are millions of other Americans. We have been fighting a war of terror in this country for decades, a war based on ancient superstition and lies, a war without end, a war that fills the pockets of multinational corporations and steals from the pockets of the poor, the disenfranchised, and the minorities. This war was started by hypocrites using yellow journalism, fabricated tales of death and woe. Starting about a century ago, though, many studies have been done by venerated committees worldwide. The Canadian report is the latest, and in my opinion, the greatest of these reports. 600 pages of in-depth and quite easily understood facts that decry the war against cannabis. But before the ink was dry on the report, and certainly before anyone could have read and understood such an in-depth report, likely the day of its issuance, letters from law enforcement, pseudoscientists, and others began to be published, proclaiming the report to be flawed and inadequate. The U.S. drug czar went so far as to say, the claim that medical marijuana is an efficacious medicine is a lie. He went further to say, it is used by people who want to legalize marijuana cynically. But in my lifetime, I have accumulated my own data, as have millions of other cannabis consumers. Cannabis serves as a sacrament for many religions, as a medicine for dozens of physical maladies, and as a social lubricant for millions of people who prefer cannabis. The lies of the drug warriors always claim mental impairment, physical harm, and social destruction result from the use of cannabis. The millions of successful and productive people who use cannabis on a regular basis know the government lies every day to protect, to maintain their jihad. I think it's time to take a stand, to show these elected officials that we will no longer put up with their lies, that we can and will destroy their careers if they continue to spout the propaganda of prohibition. Now, having said all that, to get it off my chest, I guess the bust in California of the best and the most legal of the lot out there has got me riled. And I am quite proud to introduce my first guest for the night, Senator Pierre Claude Nolan. Senator Nolan?
Yes.
Welcome, sir. Thank you for staying up so late with us tonight.
Pleasure.
Yes, sir.
I took a little nap before the show.
Well, that's wonderful, sir. If you would, please tell us about yourself and about your report.
I'm a Francophone senator from the province of Quebec. I was born and raised in Montreal and was appointed to the Senate in 1993. And the story of the committee, if you're interested in that part, I think it's interesting.
Yes,
we
sir.
Started my legislative body, the Canadian Senate, got interested in the subject in 1996, and during that period, our parliament was asked to adopt a new law to control substances. And when the bill reached the Senate, we heard many witnesses, and after 3 months of hearing, the Committee of Legal and Constitutional Affairs were all convinced that we know too little to at least to recommend an alternative, but we were convinced that prohibition was leading us nowhere. So we recommended we reluctantly adopted the bill, but recommended a bicameral committee to look into all the illegal substances. To make a long story short, it's in 1999 the Canadian Senate adopted a motion to create a special committee that made the report last almost 2 weeks ago.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
It's an interesting story of people that are interested in the well-being of all Canadians, and not the traditional place where you would see a group of Canadians supporting
contentious.
We're used to contentious debate in the Canadian Senate, but to be so bold, and I'm very proud of my institution.
Yes, sir. I think you should be. I've not had time to read the whole 600 pages.
It took me 4 months to write it, so you can take a few days to read it.
I think you should commend the staff or the printer or whoever. This is a great read.
It's a collective work.
Yes, sir.
Because as you will go along reading the report, we're covering all the subject.
Yes, sir. I note the very first item within the summary that I have here is the glossary of key terms, and the first word, abuse, vague term with a variety of meanings depending on the social, medical, and legal context. And that is the crux of the issue in my mind. Who gets to determine abuse, and what are they going to do about it, I guess?
That's why we're avoiding using the word. But many people will understand that as probably an underlying conclusion of everything, all that report, it's probably the same for wine, alcohol, tobacco, and everything. Use is not the problem. Abuse is everything. Everything, our concern goes to abuse. Now, of course, it's a vague term.
Yeah.
And the report, we're taking great care to define not the abuse, but the at-risk use, and at the end, the excessive use, which are the big concern we must have as a society.
Yes, sir. I do also want to thank you for guesting with us yesterday on the New York Times Drug Policy Forum.
It was a pleasure. It was my first chat, and I was very pleased by the experience, and I hope we'll do it again.
Yes, sir. That transcript will be up online on the New York Times as of Monday or Tuesday. I can't say when they'll post it, but I do prepare the transcript, and I'll make sure it gets there ASAP. I wanted to kind of go over Donald Way on the New York Times had asked about the age of majority or however it's determined at being 16, and your response I thought was quite telling. Would you
get it again? Yes, we have to draw the line somewhere. Like any when you talk about regulating an attitude. To use the age of majority, I think your audience should know that in Canada, it's a provincial matter. It means that various provinces can statutorily decide at what age me or my sons or my daughter can start smoking, drinking alcohol, voting, doing a lot of let's say, adult pattern or attitudes. I mentioned it is territory. It means that it is a legislative decision. It is a political decision. I became an adult at the age of 21, probably like your parent, and my two older son became an adult at 18. Am I a better adult when I was 21 than them at 18? Probably not. It's still, that proved my point. It's it's not rigorous. So the committee decided to look beyond, into science to understand what was the a threshold that could at least help legislator to understand that before a certain age, using cannabis would be quote unquote dangerous, and after that threshold, it would be not dangerous. And we found that the human brain have receptors, cannabinoid receptors, discovered at the beginning of the last 1991. And those receptors become mature, meaning that they are fully grown around the age of 16, a little bit before, so that's why we grow around at 16.
Yes.
After saying that, the last decision will lie in the hands of legislators who will have to take what we said at 16 in consideration. Of course, the pressure will be to, let's say, adopt the age of majority. But they also will have to take in consideration that the biggest rate of use is between the age of 12 and 17. So they will have to brew all that and take, of course, I hope, understand science, but also take note of social attitude and decide, of course, the Canadian population will have a debate on all that, and they will push or they will lead or probably recommend something, and the politicians will react to that. But at least our effort was to tell them here's what is the science behind all that.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that explanation.
It's a little bit too long.
No. I think it's important that the science be shared with the public as well. I'm rather stumped by a fact that keeps coming out from the U.S. drug czars. They keep talking about how marijuana is so much more. It's not your father's marijuana. It's so potent now and so forth. And I know 30 years ago there was Thai stick, there was hashish, which is usually more potent than any marijuana available, and how they can, say that marijuana is more powerful than ever before. Perhaps as a general rule, but it doesn't seem like it's something to be so afraid of.
When I was 16 and Canadians were not smoking, of course, we're paying more to smoke flowers. The buds,
yes.
Most of smokers were smoking leaves. Pattern nowadays is different. They don't smoke leaves anymore. Of course, so the THC content, because that's probably what you're referring to, and probably what the drug czar is referring, Mr. Walters is referring to, have probably evolved because of new pattern of culture is it more potent? I think it would be at least what we have as data is proving that yes, there's the potency of cannabis is higher, but we always have to be to look at averages. Naturally grown in nature, cannabis will produce between 0.5 to 3% of THC.
Yes, sir.
That's nature. 1965, 1966, when I used it, it was probably around those numbers. Now, average, probably 8%, 9%.
Right, I know. Well, they actually have botanists, scientists that are improving the strain so that a person actually has to smoke less.
Exactly. That's the other part of the answer. Users are regulating their use based on what they have, and we've heard witnesses telling us that it's like alcohol; they'll take less.
Yes, sir. That's so true.
Less.
Well, Senator Nolan, we are going to bring in Eugene Oscapella here in just a moment. We're going
to
take a quick little break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you very much.
The war that that they wage on drugs, that they wage on marijuana. As a consequence, the most beautiful flower of our bouquet of rights has been destroyed by law enforcement.
That was Attorney Tony Serra giving a speech this past spring out in California. Eugene, can you hear us?
Yes, I certainly can.
Welcome to the Cultural Baggage. And again, thank you for staying up so late. I know this is very late for you guys.
It's a delight. I hear the senator on is also staying up late, but he's from Montreal, and they're used to staying up later than
Good evening, Eugene.
Hello, Senator. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good, good.
Yes, well, welcome to the show. Eugene, I was lucky enough to get to meet you a couple of times this year, once at the Baker International Drug Conference here at Rice University, and then out at the Normal Conference, and I must say it's a joy to have you here with us.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here. If only they're in spirit right now, not in presence, but
well,
the light beam. I'm very pleased that you're looking at this issue.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I'm most aware of about your work, Eugene, is the report on terrorists. Let me see if I can find my notes here. How drug prohibition finances and otherwise enables terrorism. And I thought it a quite telling piece. Again, would you tell the listeners about that?
Well, it's a very simple point, but it's one that is being entirely overlooked by the U.S. administration and by and large by the Canadian government, although Senator Nolan knows. I presented that paper to the committee, and he's well aware of the issue, as are the other members of his committee. But basically the point is that, look, just as drug prohibition leads to the financing of organized crime, drug prohibition is funding terrorist groups around the world. Groups in Afghanistan, of course, there's a lot of opium being grown. Well, that opium is being used to fund illegal activities, be they criminal activities or potentially terrorist activities. We see the same thing in Colombia. We see it in many other countries around the world, where drug prohibition makes these drugs so profitable that it helps to finance terrorist groups just in the same way that it finances ordinary criminal groups. So in a sense, by our policies of drug prohibition, we are helping to finance the people who want to kill us. And it's such a just a few days after such a tragic date of September 11th in the United States, it's something that I would hope that the U.S. administration would look at more honestly, because it's putting its own citizens at risk by ignoring that very fact.
Yes, this is true. I know that they ran a series of ads here trying to tie use of drugs to terrorism, and then they used their own brand of, here in the U.S., their own brand of terrorism to go after people like Valerie Corral and at the Santa Cruz WAM, the Women's Area Medical Marijuana Club.
Yes, I've been reading about that. That is frightening, the sort of the use of the police power to, it looks like a case of intimidation, but how we define it as terrorism, some people may call it terrorism, but it's certainly a very unsavory action in a democratic society. That's the only way I can look at it.
Yes, this is true. I'll ask you a blunt question. Have you had a chance to read the whole 600 pages of this?
No, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I just received the full 600 pages today, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I've read the summary, and obviously there are some parts of the report that are of particular interest, but the report, as Senator Nolan may have told you, is much broader than just discussing the issue of legalization. It's talking about setting up a proper commission to review drug policies and to look at alcohol and tobacco and the currently illegal drugs, and to look at them all in the same light, and to have rational policies and have appropriately funded research. Those are all, very key recommendations. What I'm looking forward to in the larger report is summaries of the science and how the Senate arrived at its conclusions, because that's the key part. You may remember that yesterday the U.S. Drug Czar John Walters really took a swipe at Canada and said that the Senate report was naive and it wasn't based in science, and there was. Quite frankly, I think if he or his officials had taken the time to read the report, he'd find just the opposite.
Well, I don't know. Their scientific work here bears further investigation, is all I can say. They miss the mark so often.
What Walter said yesterday was that the United States has the most powerful, successful, and I'm quoting this, sophisticated medical institutions in the history of humankind, and therefore, I guess by extrapolation, they are therefore right in their opinions on these things. And he's said that the claim that medical marijuana is efficacious medicine is a lie. It is being used by people who want to legalize marijuana. That's what he said yesterday in Detroit.
He makes one wonder how long they can hold up. I don't think their science is going to bear much more scrutiny.
Well, I don't think it's science anymore. I think we all have to look at this as propaganda. If you define propaganda as information that is designed to control people rather than to inform them, then that's really what the message coming out is. That's propaganda, not science. And it's designed to control people, not to inform them honestly. I don't think there's really being an attempt to inform people honestly about the issues. And that's why I'm so pleased with the Senate report, because I believe it is an attempt to have an honest, rational, intelligent discussion of the issue based on science and sound public policy rather than on based on propaganda.
Well, this is true. I recall at the conference here at Rice University, there was like 99 people talking about, you know, harm reduction and human rights and, you know, finding better ways. And then there was one man who came in and railed against all the others. And I guess they think we're all out of step but the DEA. I don't quite follow that. I'll tell you what, we're going to take just a quick little break. I want to take your calls. Our number here, 713-526-5738, and want to give you a little bit more of that interview I did with Valerie Corral. Perhaps we can talk about what she has to say as well.
You know, I want to tell you a little bit about our organization. Also, in light of this raid, it gave us an opportunity to explain to these agents who we are and what we were doing, and they very much saw a different picture from what they might have expected, because really we saw that when they came to discover who we are, the work that we do with one another in our collective effort to supply medicine for ourselves, that when they saw that, they were really quite changed and moved. They felt differently about their jobs, and we even saw one of the agents a tear. We're a collective of patients, and what we do is provide medicine without sales or buying, purchase of marijuana. We supply through a collective effort in a large garden whereby many of our membership works, including our caregivers. And in that supply effort, we also care for one another very intimately in the process of our facing death and throughout our illnesses. I've been by the bedside of literally hundreds of my friends during their dying process. And WAM is really a community. This is why I think that 250 people in a town, seaside town in California, can have such an incredible impact on the world. It's because what we're doing is really a humanitarian effort. And in light of the anniversary of a sorrowful, terrifying moment of September 11th, that our federal government would mask their actions under a time when our nation is at mourning, and that they would attempt to create harm to 250 sick and dying people in California, that they would deny due process, that they would really ignore the democratic process by saying that now, because we don't like the issue, states' rights are not valid. We don't respect the states' rights and the legitimacy of the state law, which, mind you, got a higher percentage of votes than our president and any of the politicians in our community and in our, as well as our governor. It's, you know, I see something in this that gives us an opportunity to have a voice in the nation, to speak to Americans across the nation, and to ask America to say no to a federal government who would exact harsh treatment and harsh punishment against sick and dying people when all we really want is access to less suffering. Well, on Tuesday, we're going to have an action. We're going to continue to not break the law. We're going to offer our medicine. It's an open action. We have the support of our local politicians, of city council, of supervisors, of our love law enforcement. We're asking politicians across the state to be present in this sign and show of solidarity. It is a display of the courage that it takes to speak truth, because if we are silenced, then we have no alternative. And it'd be simple if you could just come and arrest illness and arrest death, the tragedy, but we're kept from the right to be able to find what relief we can. You know, they keep saying change the law, we keep changing the law, and they keep arresting us.
That was Valerie Corral. I want to ask you, gentlemen, if you will, to tell us what influence you think this new report will have on the medical marijuana situation in Canada.
Eugene, you want to start?
You go ahead, Senator Nolan. I'm going to speak quite a bit.
I think it would be important for your audience to understand where we're coming from in Canada on that very important point. We have constitutional laws and charters of rights and freedom, and the Canadian courts have decided 2 years ago, and it was not appealed by the federal government, that the actual body of law prohibiting the use and cultivation of cannabis was contrary to the fundamental rights of an epileptic individual who was using cannabis to control his problem. It's important to know that. After that, the government was forced to or change the law or to adopt a regulation, which they did. And that's why we have in Canada a regulation on the use of medicinal marijuana. The committee have reviewed the history of medical use of marijuana. We have reported the state of knowledge now. We know it's an evolving science, like every other science. There's known for a very long time cure or ways to use marijuana and reason why to use marijuana for therapeutic reasons. We also examine the regulation. The way it works now, doctors are, to put it bluntly, the gatekeepers of the process. They must be there at the beginning of it's an exemption scheme by which a patient can have access to his own produced marijuana or cannabis, or have access to marijuana grown for him or her by a friend. Doctors are at the beginning of the process. They need to support as they would prescribe the substance. If the regulation contain a list of illnesses and state condition of the patient that trigger the use of one general practitioner or one expert, medical expert, or two medical experts, depending on the condition. We've reviewed the implementation of that regulation, and we came with strong recommendation to amend the regulation to still use the role and to maintain the role of general physician as master of diagnosis. We recommend that at the end of the conclusion on the diagnosis, the patient remain the most important person to decide what should be the treatment. I think Canada is a little bit different than the U.S. on that. We've followed the decision of your Supreme Court on the use of medical marijuana. We're in Canada, at least on that one, a little bit different than you. But we're probably we need to improve our system, and that's exactly what the Senate had recommended.
Thank you, Senator. We do have some callers online. I want to remind you again our number here, 713-526-5738. Let's see if we can get somebody online here. Hello, caller. Can you hear us?
Hi, this is John.
Hello, John.
Hey, man. How's it going?
It's going well. I hear you. Do you have a question for Eugene or the Senator Nolan?
For both of them. Reports in the Canadian press express support, but also seem to bow to the U.S. pressure. It seemed to be a tremendous concern for what the U.S. is going to do and react. And I just wonder if Canadian people and the officials are aware that the American people actually support the ending of arrest for marijuana, 60% in the Zogby poll, and do they get some kind of feel some kind of support from the people as opposed to what the government does?
Eugene, why don't you start, and I too have something to say on that.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Senator. Well, on this point, John, thank you for raising this issue, because Canadians, you know, we're a country of 30 million people, and we are very sensitive to pressure from the United States. Just as I said yesterday in Detroit, the U.S. Drug Czar, John Walters, essentially suggested that they might tighten up trade restrictions or tighten up the border with Canada if we went ahead with reforms. What we have been trying to do from our position in the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy is remind Canadians that the American administration, the U.S. administration, may be hostile to reform, but that many, many Americans, like Canadians, are very strongly in favor of reform. So
right.
That's what, you know, we're trying to make people less fearful of change. There's good editorial opinion in favor of change. There's been some reactionary press, but the editorial opinion from the major papers in the country has been quite supportive of the Senate's recommendations. And also, you know, if you look at the letters that are being written to the editor, many of them coming from the United States, by the way, thank you very much. They're raising the point that, look, we have to move ahead and don't follow the American model, break away from the American model. One of my colleagues in the United States has suggested that this is probably a very good time for Canada to develop an independent policy, because the United States has bigger fish to fry right now. I mean, there's obviously the overarching concern about terrorism, the possibility of war with Iraq. This is a good opportunity for Canada to move now, while the United States is really looking at other truly more important issues.
If I may add, and I totally agree with what Eugene have just said, let's add that we fully understand that the United States of America is not a monolithic nation. The reaction will be of various nature. So we fully understand that the American population is not different than the Canadian population. They beg for a neutral, objective, and informed debate, and they at the end of the day, the nation, the population is in charge. They decide. And they will, what I personally want is a national debate in both countries, exactly what we are doing tonight, reaching to people, giving them, telling them, look, there's information available. Be part of the discussion. Let's get rid of the myths and the bullshit and look at the real facts.
That's tremendous.
And that is critical. Nobody believes that there's going to be some change next week.
Right.
If we can trigger a valid and an objective and an adult debate, we will do something. We're going to be able to do something.
Great. Well, I hope as we go forward in this that we can figure out a way to reach across the borders and help each other in what we're trying to accomplish.
We will, look, it's what we call real politics. We're going to have to. We're going to have to. It's look at North America is a continent that lives on on so important thread, and it's a community. Two countries of a strong, let's even say three countries, making one community. So we're going to have to move along, but we don't accept, and I'm sure your population doesn't accept fast ones and false statements. Of course, in the U.S., you have a reality that probably we have in a less way. I call the prohibition community. In the U.S., even all proportion taken in consideration, the prohibition business in your country is bigger than in our country. And I think Eugenie would agree with me on that one.
Yes, and you know, much of this debate, when you get right down to it, as I think we all know, is that it's not so much about protecting the public, rather it's about protecting the interests that benefit from prohibition, the obviously organized crime, the police groups that get a lot of their budgets because of prohibition, the private prison building industry particularly, which is very strong in the United States. There are a lot of people who make a lot of money off the present system, and those are really the people that you have to, you know, that's the simple reality of this debate about drug policy. It's not just about what's the best for you know, protecting people from the harms associated with drugs. It's really about how do we dislodge some of the vested interests and show them for what they are.
I think we have to also agree that there is a segment of the population in both countries, and I would be interested to understand the scope of that segment in the U.S. is those who are saying whatever the evidence, it's morally wrong to do it. I respect that there is a group in the Canadian society advocating that angle. I don't agree with them, but I respect their opinion. How is the size of that segment in the U.S.? In Canada, I thought it was bigger than it is in reality. It's there, but it's not as huge as someone would think.
Senator Nolan, if I may interrupt one second, I think it here in the U.S. it's becoming the bailiwick of fewer and fewer people, and those that remain are bleating in the desert, as far as I'm concerned. We do have some other callers. John, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. Is this Stacy?
Yeah, this is Stacy.
Hello, Stacy.
How you doing?
I'm well. Do you have a question for Senator Nolan?
I had a comment. You were talking earlier about drugs and terrorism and the purchase of drugs being linked to terrorism. And it was reported in the Los Angeles Times back in May of 2001 that the United States government gave $43 million to the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan to stop growing opium.
Yes, I remember that report, and there was some dispute as to whether that money was actually given directly to the Taliban. But that's whether in that case is you know, I'm not clear on the final facts, the true facts in that case. But there's no doubt that that in the past sometimes money has been you know, drug trafficking has been a major consideration, and they've allowed other things such as the development of terrorism for the sake they wanted to get after drug trafficking, and they haven't paid enough attention to terrorism. Essentially,
right.
I think that's the best way I can describe
it.
This may be a perfect example. As I say, I don't know if this case there was some dispute as to whom the money was actually given, but that's a good point. I mean, that if your number one priority is stopping drugs, then you're going to let terrorists get away with things, and maybe we should be focusing more on the terrorists.
Certainly. Eugene, I wanted to point out that even now the Karzai government is unable to control the heroin growth and the poppies growth and the heroin production in Afghanistan.
No, it can't be stopped, and I think they're predicting that it's going to be another bumper crop just as it was a few years ago. So, you know, we all know that prohibition doesn't stop the production of drugs. It creates a much greater incentive to produce them.
Certainly, the balloon effect. It's going to find a home somewhere.
Yeah.
Balloon effect, no pun intended.
Oh, yeah. I nodded at first, so I hear you.
That's all I have.
Okay, Stacy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to remind the callers, we do have some lines open now. I'm sorry to the caller from San Antonio. Please, we'll try again if you will. The number here is 713-526-5738. Gentlemen, I wanted to ask you, you know, I know it's hard sometimes to phrase an answer, to do it diplomatically, and I'm certain that for you, Senator Nolan, that, you know, I guess the superstition here in America is so ingrained, so deep-rooted. I talked to my parents about it, and they're all for now for ending prohibition, but they still don't quite feel right about it because it was so embedded in their youth to have these great fears and to believe the superstition. Canada, in fact, has had their prohibition laws about as long as we have, perhaps a little earlier for some drugs, a little later for others. But it doesn't seem to be as ingrained up there. People are willing to talk. And give us some advice. How can we open those avenues of communication here?
That is the moral component that I referred to earlier. When we read the report, I direct you to Chapter 3. For us, it was the fundamental pillar of that report. We are examining in Chapter 3 the principles on which we think that a policy on psychoactive substances should be built on. In that chapter, we're examining four fundamental areas. The ethical component of such policy. We're examining the role of the state. When I say the state, the government. The role of the penal law, and finally the role of science. Those four principles for us are fundamental. When you are examining that, you're finding that we believe that if I take the ethical principle, as a guideline, a guideline, we have adopted the principle that I'm reading in my summary.
Okay.
We've adopted the principle that an ethical public policy on illegal drugs and on cannabis in particular must promote reciprocal autonomy built through a constant exchange of dialogue within the community. So it means that we believe that each individual must be in charge of their own decision. More, the community should respect that and promote the dialogue between the membership of that group. For us, it's very important. I can believe in something and decide what's good for me or what's bad for me based on the values that I have for myself. But I cannot impose on anybody those values. Do you understand the fundamental?
Oh, I do, sir.
And that probably answer your question. I have moral values. Eugene has moral values. But who are we to impose on the rest of Canadians our moral values?
Right, and I think it's just...
it's for us so clear. We're not saying that we cannot, as a society, share values to a point that we should enshrine in policies those values. It's a little bit dangerous. We have charters of freedom, rights and freedom protecting individual rights. That leads us to the penal law. What's the role of penal law? It was for too long used to decide by the majority what is okay to do or not okay to do. Think of a tough issue as prostitution.
Right.
If you want an area of discussion where opinions are very, very explosive, of course we are for all kinds of reasons prohibiting in Canada. We have our own way to do that. We're prohibiting the solicitation of for prostitution. were not specifically prohibiting prostitution. Are we imposing our moral values to achieve that? Probably another Senate committee of the Senate will discuss the matter, and probably in the near future, because we believe that the penal law we should only offense create offenses involving significant direct danger to others, and criminal law should not serve moral values or defend moral values. It may be tough for some of your audience to listen to hear that, but we strongly believe that the penal law should be there to achieve that, not more than that.
Yes, sir. I don't know if I dare draw this comparison, but that situation regarding prostitution sounds a little more like decrim than legalization.
Look, it has been there for the last 10,000 years.
Yes, sir. Oh, we do have another caller. Let's see if we can get Duke online here. Can you hear us, Duke?
Yes, sir, I can hear you.
Hi, welcome to Cultural Baggage. Do you have a question for the senator, for Eugene Nolan?
Yes, sir. I was wondering, what is the holdup on legalizing marijuana for medicinal purposes in the United States? I mean, is it just mainly just the politicians, or is it what is it? I mean,
I think the in Canada the big difference was the court. The court took they read the and they analyzed our Charter of Rights and Freedom, and decided that it was the actual prohibition of controlled substances was contrary to those fundamental individual rights of the patient, who, in a specific case of that triggered the regulation, it was for a political reason. In the U.S., I think the situation is more surrounded and influenced by the medical community. And they don't support cannabis as a medication because it didn't go through all the very rigorous process of accepting a medication in the compendium of medication, pharmacopoeia, as we say in more specifically. But I think in Canada the courts have pushed for the quote unquote revolution. In your country, the courts have stopped that revolution.
Every opportunity.
To answer your question, I think it's political will is the answer. In Canada, it was not even political will; it was a tribunal will that made the difference.
Well,
Eugene, do you want to add something onto that?
Well, no, I agree very much. In Canada, the courts have been quite. There have been a number of courts now that have basically supported access to medical marijuana, saying that, look, denying access to this violates people's constitutional rights. Their right to, in Canada, the particular right involved is the right to life, liberty, and security of the person. That's sort of the Canadian version of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But they're saying that the courts are saying that, look, if you're denying a person access to this therapeutic product, you're denying them right to in some cases, life, liberty, and security of the person. So, and there's also a Supreme Court of Canada hearing that's going to be held on the constitutionality of the cannabis law in general, and that will probably be heard in December.
Yeah, the exact date, it's a Friday the 13th.
Another Friday the 13th. So we'll cross our fingers on that one.
As lucky as today.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court, I've been following the rhetoric of the Supreme Court of Canada on drug policy issues, and occasionally they go a bit overboard, but they're much more temperate in their language than some of the higher courts in the United States. So it's quite possible, I don't know how likely, but it's at least possible that the Supreme Court of Canada will declare our cannabis possession law to be unconstitutional. So that's another, way. Our courts in Canada are first of all, our judges are appointed, they're not elected, and I think that makes a bit of a difference. because there's not as much, you don't have to sort of pander to some of the harsher elements of society in order to become a judge. So that may make a bit of a difference here, but you know, watch for that. Watch, probably by February or March, the Supreme Court of Canada will have decided this issue, so that could be another big news day.
Okay, thank you, Eugene. Duke, we appreciate the call. We've got time for one more caller. Let's see, it's Dwayne Jones. Do you hear us, Dwayne?
Yes, sir. Dean, appreciate your program there.
Well, thank you so much.
Again, I had asked your screener there about a forecast in the December court date that's coming up again on another Friday, the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
So you, do you forecast a positive outcome on a court review?
Well, it's very difficult for me as a parliamentarian to comment on a decision, a future decision of the Supreme Court. But I think the court will have to decide if the body of knowledge that is permitting or was permitting Parliament to prohibit, does that body of knowledge is still there to still prohibit? Maybe my answer is not as precise as you would like, but I cannot go further than that. Maybe Eugene, you want to go further, but I cannot.
Well, I think, I mean, the Supreme Court now, as a matter of fact, I was just reading the factum, the appellant's factum before the Supreme Court last night. There's some very, very good arguments about the Supreme Court has already argued, you know, found in some other cases that the state doesn't have, you know, the government and all our drug laws in Canada, by the way, are federal. We don't have to worry about federal and state conflicts. But the Supreme Court basically was, in other cases, has said that, you know, the government's got to have a good reason for interfering with the individual private behaviors. And if they follow that line, they've now got good scientific studies. They've got the Senate report, which they can refer to, and that's the beauty of it as an educational document. I'm hoping the court will refer to it to look at the science. You know, they may come out, but judges are human. That's the, and you know, maybe the fear of backlash. I hope it won't affect them, but it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. But I think our court is less driven by the rhetoric of prohibition than the U.S. Supreme Court has been. So I've got more hope that the Canadian Supreme Court will make a decision based on the evidence and the sort of rational argument than on the sort of prohibitionist zeal.
Could you elaborate also any U.S. interference that might be directed towards you since, again, the DEA has already been up there one time here before, here a while back, behind the scenes?
Well, are you referring to the case? There was a case in 1999, and a British Columbia judge just lambasted the DEA for carrying out an illegal operation in Canada in 1999. There was a court decision in just on August 1st of this year, just so a month and a half ago, strongly criticizing the DEA for completely ignoring internet or agreements between bilateral agreements between our two countries and coming up and carrying out an operation in Canada without government approval and which is a very serious violation of our sovereignty in the same sense that if we went into the United States and carried out a police operation without the approval of the U.S. government, that would be a serious one. So there is interference in that sense. I don't know what goes on behind closed doors. I don't know how much the U.S. administration is leaning on the Canadian government. I know there have been a number of statements by senior officials like John Walters yesterday, as I don't know if you were listening earlier in the program, but, you know, he was very strongly critical, very harshly critical of Canada's, move of the Senate report and trying to move forward with reform in Canada, and he was threatening that it might affect our trade relations. So, you know, those threats are going to be there, but I don't know how they're going to play out, and Senator Nolan is probably in a better position to know what goes on behind closed doors than I am, so he may be able to comment on that.
There's a reality, as I mentioned earlier. We're living in a community of three important nations, and our trading is so immense that we cannot avoid to think and take note of the reaction of the two others when we are deciding on fundamental laws and social policies. Saying that, I think Canada on that subject will want the debate to go on, and I believe that the Canadian government will want to do something. The Justice Ministry have already is reported as few hours after we stable our report, he went public saying that the actual law was outdated. It's a very strong message from the government. He is, I believe, the lead on the question. We have four important ministers having a stake in that policy. The Justice Minister is now, I'm between the lines, he's the lead minister on the subject. And he went on to say that the actual prohibition policy is outdated. He wants to, as a first step, he also said that. He as a first step, he wants to propose decriminalization. Nobody would have even dreamed of such a statement 6 months ago. It's moving along. Is there going to be pressure from the U.S.? Of course there's going to be pressure.
Well, is there any way that we could also, tell us why that we're almost having, without the Internet, sir, I wouldn't have any access to your findings. Is there any way that we could spread this report?
Oh, yes.
To our U.S. media? How do we get in the door? I mean, how do we spread our findings, maybe to the this Nevada initiative that we have coming up in our elections in this?
Let me interrupt. We are running out of time. I'm sorry to do this. I want to thank Senator Nolan. I want to thank Eugene Oscapella for staying up late with us. Dwayne, thank you for your call.
Yeah, wonderful program.
I appreciate that. We'll have a link up tomorrow on my website, cultural-baggage.com, where you can reach this report by the Senate. And I'll also have a link to a couple of Eugene's website up as well. Gentlemen, any closing words you'd like to relay? Quickly, please.
Senator, please go ahead.
Let's have an interesting debate. I want to say a population, a people's debate. That's what we need. We need people to be properly informed, and that's exactly what we're trying to achieve.
Thank you, sir. And Eugene?
I agree very much. If we can get people talking, we're going to get sensible solutions.
Gentlemen, once again, thank you, and good night.
Thank you, Dean. Good night, Senator.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of DrugSense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker. For Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth.